This is Bristol Band Beyond, our weekly news magazine on KDLG. It's Friday, November 6th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week, if a bear falls in the forest, is there anyone there to hear it?
What's happening to this cub? What's going on? And the first day, the cub moved a little, but it didn't ever return to its feet.
We'll look at how webcam viewers from around the world are helping the park rangers at Katmai keep an eye on their featured wildlife. The new president of the University of Alaska, Jim Johnson, joins us to talk about higher education in an era of belt-tightening budgets.
I'm not interested in across-the-board cuts. You can get a gorilla to do that. That's not leadership. Leadership is actually, if there are cuts, is understanding where our priorities are, where we need to grow, even during tough times.
Plus, health officials are noticing a rise in reported cases of a viral infection that may be tied to the rise in drug use in town.
Hepatitis C is also spread by blood and body fluids. That means you get it from sharing needles with people, from having sex with people who have it.
Dr. Kathy Heineman tells us more. And of course, we have to offer a little preview of this weekend's coffee house here in Dillingham.
Breaking the law, breaking the law. Certain things you can't deny, like 1 + 1 = 2. With fractions when you multiply, well, they must be reduced.
Those stories and more are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. The Department of Fish and Game released its forecast for the 2016 sockeye return to Bristol Bay, predicting another big one, $46.5 million, which is slightly down from last year's monster run, but still ahead of the 10-year average. Area research biologist Chuck Brazil put the numbers together this fall.
For the Naknek-Quijac District, we're expecting approximately 23 million fish to return. For the Agagic District, about 7.4 million sockeye. The Ugashic District, 4.95 million. And in the Nushagak District, 10.3 million. And in Togiak, about 660,000 sockeye.
Managers for the four major districts tell us they're expecting big harvests and are not too concerned about meeting their escapement goals. The University of Washington's Fisheries Research Institute put its own forecast out yesterday, predicting a 51 million sockeye run. NOAA released its report on the nation's fisheries for 2014, with the total catch valued at about $5.5 billion. Alaska's was worth $1.7 billion. Dutch Harbor's port moved the most fish for the 18th year in a row. Port of Bristol Bay and Naknek moved $135 million worth of seafood, making it the fifth most valuable on the list of U.S. seafood ports last year. Despite a population that has met the minimum threshold for a hunt, the Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council has voted to put off an emperor goose harvest for at least another year. AMBCC Rep. Gayla Hosseth explained to the Subsistence Rack last week that the management kinks hadn't been worked out for the number of birds that could have been taken.
So 3,500 would have to be divided amongst four different regions. That would be Kodiak, Aleutian, Pribilofs, Bristol Bay, YK Delta, and the Norton Sound area. Bristol Bay would have got like 500 emperor geese. And then we were sent the homework to bring back to our regional councils as to how are we going to divvy up the 500 birds within Bristol Bay.
The AMBCC meets next spring in Bethel. This week in Bethel, the Yupik Immersion School was destroyed in a dramatic early morning fire Tuesday. Fire marshals arrived to help Bethel Fire Chief Bill Howell begin an investigation after the fires had finally been contained by Wednesday.
Basically, the process is reconstructing, you know, trying to find where the fire started, what might have started it. The areas of greatest damage often lead us to the area where the fire started.
An area of the school containing many Yupik artifacts and hundreds of elder interviews was spared fire damage, though they're still assessing damages from water and smoke. State officials have committed their support, and the city is working on a disaster declaration to seek more funds to rebuild. The special session of the legislature came to an end following a 16-3 vote of the Senate and a 39-0 vote of the House to pass a bill designed to advance Alaska's role in the LNG pipeline project. Lawmakers agreed to buy out TransCanada's share and to fund more of the state's work. Just ahead of the House vote, Representative Liz Vasquez said the vote was a good way to show the state's faith in moving forward on the mega project.
It will, if it's completed, will supply 5% of the LNG supplies in the world. It is truly a monumental task, as explained by our experts and industry partners. What we're doing here is we're simply writing a check. We're paying the bill.
The bill appropriates about $158 million, including $68 million to buy out TransCanada. The 13-day session costs the state about $400,000. This week, a petition drafted by Bristol Bay drifter Eric Sabo calling on Fish and Game Commissioner Sam Cotton to intervene in the low prices paid to Bristol Bay fishermen this past season was circulated around social media.
I hate to see 50 cents. I can't believe it. I've been in a state of shock and depression since I've, you know, put the boat up. And even though we're at this terrible level, I think that it is bringing people together.
As of this morning, the petition had more than 600 signatures. On Capitol Hill Thursday, the U.S. House Committee on Science held a hearing examining the role of the EPA in creating proposed preemptive restrictions against the Pebble Mine. The hearing was called following the release of the Cohen Report, which was critical of EPA's methods and preemptive use of 404C restrictions. Former Defense Secretary William Cohen told the members of Congress there were policy questions with the Clean Water Act that he recommends they address.
Do you think under the 404C process that there should be a permit filed? Do you think that EPA should say, in the absence of that, we will construct a hypothetical scenario and make judgments on what can be done? I think those are policy issues that you as a member would want.
Pebble CEO Tom Collier also testified Thursday, laying out his case that the preemptive restrictions are unfair for a developer like Pebble. His testimony came just a day after another House committee released more EPA documents and emails lending credence to Pebble's claim that the agency's approach has been predetermined. While the EPA declined an invite to speak to its own defense, former Alaska State Senator Rick Halford, a Pebble opponent, did.
You've heard today that EPA has been unfair and has made its mind up in advance. Neither of these things could be further from the truth. The truth is that while EPA was far from the first choice of the people of Bristol Bay in terms of getting someone to listen, EPA was the only choice with the authority and the jurisdiction that had the interest to help.
And also in Washington Thursday, President Barack Obama addressed the White House Tribal Nations Conference. On stage with the president was Tatiana Ticknor, a 16-year-old of Yupik, Dena'ina, and Tlingit heritage from Anchorage.
But up first, we have Tatiana.
Hello.
Hello.
So my question is there any way you can get teachers to understand Alaska Native and American Indian students more better? And is there a way that we can get rid of or eliminate stereotyping and racism within schools?
More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Let's begin this week with a short update on that petition making its rounds through social media, mainly on Facebook. Those signing hope they're doing so could help set the stage for some regulatory action, perhaps, that could see better pay, or at least get them better information from their processors. Joining me now for more is Molly Dishner, who covers fish for KDLG and the Bristol Bay Times. Molly, good morning.
Morning.
Before we talk about the petition itself, what do we know about the fish prices? Have they been adjusted since the end of the season?
Not really. People have been getting some chilling, icing, and bleeding bonuses, but no actual adjustments to the base price.
Those were to be expected at some point in the fall, but we're not seeing processors adjust yet.
Not yet.
I have to imagine that's led into some of the frustration, which has prompted at least this petition.
Right. Eric Sabo said he was waiting a little while to see how things played out this fall, but prices haven't gotten any better, so he opened up his petition and in the first 24 hours said about 400 people, some fishermen, some not, signed on, saying they were also unhappy and wanted some help from the state of Alaska.
Okay, what will this petition do? One of the comments on Facebook, and this went everywhere on Facebook this week, I remember reading one comment, somebody said, "I'll sign it because I don't mind tilting at windmills," a Don Quixote reference there. What could happen?
The petition is asking the state of Alaska to come in, get a mediator, get the fishermen to sit down with the processors, and the mediator would come from Department of Labor, I think, and talk about what a fair price is, open up some of the books maybe, and show them this is fair, or say, hey, this isn't really reasonable.
You spoke with Fish and Game this week just to get a kind of a preview of what might happen if they reach the signature threshold. What did the department tell you?
The department says it's a little bit tricky. They need a third of the permit holders in an area, and it's unclear what's going to be defined as the area, if it's going to be all of Bristol Bay, if it'll be drifters and set netters. It's also unclear how electronic signatures are going to count or if they'll count. Fish and Game says they'll pretty much have to look to the Department of Law for help. But that's all pretty speculative. They won't make any real comments until they've actually seen it.
Well, what's the time frame on gathering signatures, and when could this happen down the road before next season, I imagine?
Sabo wants to collect most of the signatures at Fish Expo, get it finalized sometime after that. He didn't give an exact time frame. The state statute says the mediation would happen 120 days before the start of the fishing season.
Well, we will continue to follow along. Molly Dishner covers the Fish Beat for KDLG and for the Bristol Bay Times newspaper. Molly, thanks for the update.
Yep, no problem.
Last Friday, University of Alaska President Jim Johnson was in Dillingham and sat down with me to talk about his vision for leading the university through tough fiscal times. Dr. Johnson is the 14th president of UA and took over on September 1st. He spent some 12 years in executive roles with UA in the past and also brings private sector experience with Doyon Limited and Alaska Communications to the job. The university is dependent to the state for more than a third of its funding, and as the state is planning deep cuts to try and balance its books, I asked Dr. Johnson if the state and the university were in something of a crisis.
I would say that it is a crisis.
How is that going to play out? I've seen some of the discussions that have happened with you in the Board of Regents.
Mm-hmm.
Paint us a picture, if you don't mind.
Well, I think we have to start with a very big picture, and that is about 45% of the money that comes into the university comes from the legislature. And, of course, about 90% of the money that those guys receive comes from oil taxes and royalties. And, you know, last year the legislature had a $5 billion budget and $2 billion in revenue. So we borrowed $3 million last year from one of our—
Billion.
Billion, thank you, from one of our several savings accounts. That's not a sustainable plan at all. So we are heavily reliant on a highly variable, declining revenue source. Not a good picture for us at the university. So we're doing a couple of things. One is working with the governor's office and with legislators on a fiscal plan. So we have ICER at UAA, the Institute of Social and Economic Research, and their economists are really trying to help the state analyze options, fiscal options, you know, so that we can get ourselves on a more sustainable fiscal footing. So that's one thing we're doing. And then within the university itself, we're taking a hard look at our cost structures. You know, we've got to do that. So we're looking at everything we spend money on, and in light of our mission, in light of our priorities to grow the state and contribute to the state. So we're doing that. And then also looking at alternative revenue sources, additional revenue sources. So,
such as?
Private fundraising.
Okay.
We have huge opportunities. I mean, every year we have alumni cross stages and go out into the workforce. We need to do a better job of reaching out to our alumni to ask them to give back to the school that helped them move their careers forward.
Has UA traditionally been aggressive in that realm?
Or? No, it has not.
Okay.
So that's something that we're looking at. And another area, frankly, is tuition.
Now, I spoke with President Johnson last week, but on Wednesday this week, the Board of Regents approved a total budget of $960 million, including a $350 million request from the state. Johnson recommended a 9% hike to the tuition rate paid by students. The board settled on 5. Before that happened, he told me that he is spending a lot of time with students to get their input on a range of issues, including the price of tuition.
You know, we're not in agreement on everything, but they certainly recognize the value for the education. They're smart people, and they know that our tuition levels are low. They know that, you know, the fiscal situation we're looking at, and we're certainly not trying to balance our budget on the backs of students. But we do think it's appropriate for students to participate in the solution.
Okay. As far as making additional cuts to the system, the governor asked all state agencies for reductions kind of across the board.
You bet.
What are you going to target what are you going to recommend the university target?
Well, we're taking a two-step approach. Step one is actually to ask the governor and ask the legislature for what we believe we need. So fixed cost increases, keeping our buildings heated, paying our faculty and staff and that sort of thing. So we're actually asking for an increase. Whether we get that is a tough time.
Right.
No question about that. But in consultation with legislative leaders in the governor's office, those folks understand, and it actually is a communication, political communication agenda here as well. We need to communicate what we need. That said, we are building a contingency budget. That's what I'm calling it. And we're working hard on that, and we'll be ready in about 6 months with that. So as the legislature winds up and we see with more clarity what it is we're going to actually receive from them, at that point in time, we'll also have done the scrub across the university system. And so those two will come together, and so we won't have a surprise or a knee-jerk reaction. We'll have a plan in place come March, April
time frame. Should you not get an increase?
That's exactly right, Dave.
Now, you may be the only entity in the state that's going to ask for an increase.
Well, we believe we need it.
Okay.
There are considerable unfunded mandates, for example,
such
from
as?
The federal government. Well, a big one that we don't have a problem with, but it is an unfunded mandate, and that is Title IX.
Did I see correctly that you have recommended to the Board of Regents and in the budget a 2.5% increase for staff and faculty?
You bet. Yeah,
it's
largely.
Tough time to do that too, is it not?
Well, it is, but we've got collective bargaining agreements. We have labor contracts that provide for those increases. So we believe in honoring our contracts with our people.
With that, we've seen other positions, even here locally. We've seen park ranger positions go away. I think we've seen trooper positions going away. If it comes to it, will you be able to cut staff and faculty through the university system, or are there too many union contracts and tenure in place to block that?
We'll be able to reduce if necessary.
But you don't
want
to.
A couple thoughts here, Dave. One, no. I mean, I'd rather not, but nobody would want to do that.
Sure.
But that said, if forced to, we have the means available to do that. I mean, one thing to keep in mind, we have estimate 6,000 employees across the faculty and staff across the university system. If you assume, you know, which is a standard turnover of maybe 10%, so that's 600 positions they're going to turn through the year, right? And if you assume that they happen, you know, across the year and maybe say, okay, on average it's mid-year, that's 300 positions, right? So we'll manage through attrition as well. And that's actually one of the major ways in which the university has dealt with budget cuts for the last 2 years.
By not refilling positions rather than letting people go.
That's correct.
Okay.
And then reallocating to areas of importance. And that's one thing I really want to emphasize, Dave. I'm not interested in across-the-board cuts. You can get a gorilla to do that. That's not leadership. Leadership is actually, if there are cuts, is understanding where our priorities are, where we need to grow, even during tough times, especially during tough times.
Rural campuses seem expensive to maintain and to operate. Mm-hmm. Is there a value there that's worth the cost in your mind?
Absolutely. People do suggest that we cut some of the rural campuses, and I strongly oppose that. I believe there may be ways, again, through distance education, technology, to bring some of those costs down, increasing collaboration with high schools. You know, so I think there are some things to look at there, and I've met with Debbie McLean here and the other rural campus directors to ask them to work on those sorts of things, and they're on it, no question about it. But cutting the campuses, I don't see at all. I mean, we're a huge state, and we have a role to play, not just in Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau, but we have an important role to play in terms of community development, economic development, culture, and many, many, many other aspects of really creating a sustainable state. And so I'm personally very strongly committed to making sure our rural campuses continue to thrive.
Of course, with what may be coming cuts to the university's budget comes some concern about a potential lower quality of education students will receive. I asked Dr. Johnson what message she has for high school seniors, juniors, and sophomores as they weigh where and when to pursue their college degree.
Well, we're going to try our best to make sure that the academic programs are state needs and, you know, in terms of our workforce and that sort of thing, and in terms of what they're interested in, are available. So we're working hard on common courses, general education requirements, so that there's ease of transition from from the campus here in Dillingham to Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau or some other university.
Is that working well now?
It's working adequately now, but it's one of those things that you just you always have to work on that.
Okay.
So that's one thing. Second is dual credit opportunities. We're working with the school districts all across the state in making sure that our high school students have opportunities, whether it's through tech prep type programs, vocational programs, or traditional academic programs, that they have an opportunity to earn dual credit. So university credit at the same time they're getting high school credit. That's critical for us. The coin of the realm at the university is student success, period.
Jim Johnson is the new president of the University of Alaska system, joining us here. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for coming.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Back in a moment. Last month at Katmai National Park, the final hours of two brown bears played out on an online audience of thousands. The two animals laid down and died within days of each other. As Hannah Colton reports, bear cam viewers are acting as both eyewitnesses and detectives in this curious case.
Wednesday, October 21st, started as a normal fall day at Brooks Camp. Bears were fishing, preparing to den up. A sow and two cubs wandered in front of a camera close to Naknek Lake. Then something strange happened, something that might have gone unnoticed if it weren't for the thousands of bear cam viewers around the world.
We could see the cub stumbling and its legs not really working, and then it kind of collapsed.
That's Diana from Maryland, a 3-year veteran bear cam watcher who goes by the online name Love the Cams. She was paying close attention when the spring cub started acting strange. That evening, she says, the online comment board was swirling with confusion.
What's happening to this cub? What's going on? And the first day, the cub moved a little, but it didn't ever return to its feet.
Diana says she was counting the cub's respirations, taking careful notes. She says it took its last breath on Friday afternoon, the 23rd. Troy Hammond is the chief of resource management for Katmai National Park and Preserve. He says the staff decided to have the cub's body autopsied, so a few of his colleagues boated out and collected the 60-pound carcass.
Which is surprisingly heavy. And we shipped it to the National Wildlife Health Center in Wisconsin.
This is uncharted territory for Katmai rangers. Hammond says they've never had a bear necropsy done because they've rarely, if ever, witnessed a bear die of an unknown cause.
We see cubs especially being killed by other bears. This is why mother bears are very protective, especially around adult male bears. We also know that there are a lot of bears that go missing that we never see again. We've found bears at the bottom of cliffs. We think they probably fell down. But our understanding of sort of the non-traumatic mortality modes is fairly uncommon.
From a biologist's point of view, this was a unique opportunity to learn about bear mortality. And the rangers were about to get twice the opportunity.
The situation is when our staff pulled up to collect the cub, there were some webcam viewers that sort of clipped images from the video of our people arriving.
This compulsive documentation paid off when a few hours later, viewers looked at that same location and saw a big, dark, bear-shaped blob where there hadn't been a dark blob before. By comparing the before and after photos, they could pinpoint just when the dark shape had parked itself out on a sand spit. Hammond says this caught people's attention.
Not because the bear laid down. They started paying attention to this because it was still there the next day, and it was still there the next day. And we have bears that lay down and sleep for 6 hours. We have a few bears that might lay down for a day, but when a bear lays down for 2 days, it's dead.
Rough weather kept the wildlife staff from returning to the second body for a few days, but Hammond says he and other rangers soon determined that the deceased was an adult male. They knew that because they'd seen video footage of another sow with cubs who walked by, took one look at the body on the ground, and bolted.
The bear hierarchy system is very funny, and a very important bear remains very important even after death.
Meanwhile, on the comment board, people now had two bears to grieve and two mysterious deaths to investigate. As viewers hashed over details and reconstructed a timeline of events, Diana says they were in full-on speculation mode.
I've read everything from, you know, foul play, has someone poisoned them? Could it have been something chemical that leaked from a boat? Is it the plants? Is it the mushrooms? Could it be disease? Could it be neurological?
Ranger Michael Saxton is one of the bear technicians who collected the cub's body. He says so far only a few things have been ruled out by the lab in Wisconsin.
So rabies is negative. Toxoplasmosis is negative as well. It's just another disease that they check for. It's a contagious disease.
Samples from the adult male body were sent to a state veterinarian who said they were too decayed to do most diagnostic tests. Diana says many bear cam watchers were deeply affected by the deaths, especially the spring cubs. And there's a tension in the comments between those who are mourning the bears as you might a pet and those who see themselves more as citizen scientists. Diana is hungry for more information, but she says her mind keeps returning to certain moments, like when the sow and her healthy cub returned to where the other one lay dead.
She would sniff near the cub or approach the cub near its muzzle and seem to be checking for things. And as a mom, I understand checking for things, looking for clues of what is wrong or what's going on. And I would like to have some answers to that.
Those answers may or may not come with the results of the necropsy. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. In our region, health officials are noting an increase of reported cases of hepatitis C. While it's not necessarily a deadly infection, there is concern about how people are getting it and what it might lead to. A small town in Indiana this year made news after more than 150 people were diagnosed with HIV in a town that usually sees no more than 5 cases per year. The CDC blames intravenous drug use and unprotected sex for most of those cases, and says the rise in HIV came alongside a rise in cases of hepatitis C. Joining me now for more is family physician Kathy Hyman from the Kanakanak Hospital in Dillingham. Good as always to have you in our studio.
Such a pleasure to be here.
Is the hospital tracking this? Is this sort of on the radar for our area?
Indeed. ANMC has had, for a long time, a hepatitis specialist, and he was just out last week following the folks out here who have hepatitis B and hepatitis C. I think it would be important to sort of define hepatitis.
Right.
So hepatitis refers to the liver, and it refers to inflammation of the liver. Inflammation of the liver can come from many things, and hepatitis virus A, hepatitis virus B, virus C, they actually go all the way up to, I don't know, G, H. I don't even know how many viruses they found. But the three major ones that we have good tests for are A, B, and C. Now, hepatitis A is caused by ingesting food that is infected with that virus. For instance, if a food handler with hepatitis A goes to the bathroom, doesn't wash his hands thoroughly, and then touches the food that you then eat, you can get hepatitis A. People recover from that. They may feel mildly to, in fact, severely ill, but they will recover.
Okay.
Hepatitis B is obtained by sharing blood and body fluids with another person. It can be gotten by sex, but by far and away the most common way to get hepatitis B is through needle sharing. Mothers can also pass it along to their babies during the birth process. With hepatitis B, Many people get the disease, and some recover, but some go on to be chronic carriers of hepatitis B. Hepatitis B can cause cirrhosis of the liver. Cirrhosis is a fancy term for scarring. And when the liver becomes scarred or cirrhotic, it can no longer do its functions, which is to clean the blood of toxins.
Well, let's talk about this hepatitis C, which maybe you can explain what exactly it is and why we're concerned about it all of a sudden.
So hepatitis C is also spread by blood and body fluids. That means you get it from sharing needles with people, from having sex with people who have it, particularly if you have rough sex. And in the past, it was spread through blood transfusions. The ability to tell whether or not a blood donation had hepatitis C was only arrived at in 1992. So prior to 1992, people could have been getting transfusions of blood that were infected with hepatitis C, and there is a global recommendation that anybody born between 1945 and 1965 be tested for hepatitis C once in their lifetime to make sure that they weren't inadvertently exposed to it.
Okay, but it doesn't sound like it's a dangerous or deadly condition or malady.
The unfortunate thing is that most folks who have it don't even know when they got infected, don't know that they have it, and may not show signs of anything evil for 20 or 30 years. And then it can cause the same scarring of the liver that the hepatitis B can cause. So the reason that we are much more concerned about that now is with the rise of injectable heroin use in the community, there is always the possibility that hepatitis C will be spread along with sharing of needles.
Now, as I understand, that's one of the reasons why there is a focus or a concern about it is because diagnosed cases of hepatitis C could sort of be construed to mean that there is more needle sharing or needle use going on within the community. If it is tied to increased needle use, that it may be a harbinger of other conditions, including HIV and AIDS, becoming prevalent. I know people have been pointing to this town in Indiana that saw an enormous spike in HIV and AIDS cases that I believe was predicated by a rise in Hep C.
I read that article as well, and indeed, I believe it could be a harbinger of worsening things to come with regards to a rise in HIV cases. We've not seen that yet, but we must be constantly vigilant for that.
Should our area look at some sort of a needle exchange?
I think we need to look at the heroin use and possible treatments for it from a risk reduction standpoint. I believe that offering clean needles would reduce the risk of spreading diseases. I'm speaking from a medical perspective and not from a hospital policy perspective.
For folks that are struggling with drug use, specifically around these injectable drugs like heroin, what are their options if they're beginning to think about changing that in their life?
The options for help in Dillingham are somewhat limited. In order to do a methadone maintenance program, for instance, or a Suboxone program, there is no such program in Dillingham, and in fact, it requires a specific DEA license to be able to give those medicines for heroin treatment. None of our doctors have those licenses at this time. The closest place that you can get that kind of treatment would be in Anchorage. The hospital can offer some medicines to help with some of the withdrawal symptoms, but really, a lot of that is going to be done at home or as an outpatient, unless the patient has an already set up plan or place in a treatment center elsewhere.
Dr. Kathy Hyman, family physician at the Conaconac Hospital here in Dillingham and a regular guest on our program. It's always good to have you.
Such a pleasure to be here.
And before we go this week, the annual Dillingham Coffee House is happening this weekend. For more on that, joining me now is the MC of Saturday's event, Dillingham math teacher, singer-songwriter, Andrew Slagle. Good to have you back, by the way.
Yeah.
Coffee House. We don't get a lot of artistic outlets lately, but this is the big one.
You know, it was a lot of fun last year, so I'm excited to be a part of it this year.
Tell me about your music lately, by the way. How come we only have you on the parody beat?
Well, you know, the teaching gigs got me. I'm writing a couple songs, but none of them were, I thought, worthy of the Coffee House. I mean, this is a big event, you know, so I whipped out a parody and a math parody at that. So,
for people that don't know you or that are just getting to know you, could we point out that you're something of a metalhead?
I am, and I, yes.
Unapologetically, by the way.
Yeah, and I did a heavy metal radio show in Fairbanks for 5 years, every week, 2 hours a week for 5 years, and I had a blast. It was a lot of fun.
If you had to take three albums to a deserted island for a year, what would they be?
That is a not fair question on such short notice. Probably Metallica's Ride the Lightning would be up there. You got to have some classics. Iron Maiden, Brave New World. That's kind of, I know that's a late Iron Maiden album, but, and I get made fun of for liking that album so much. It came out in like 2000 or something, but all the early metalheads make fun of me for that. But I love that CD, and I'm going to regret this, but probably Symphony X, The Odyssey, which is an album about Homer's Odyssey.
Who'd you see this summer, by the way?
A lot of bands. There were about 120 bands at the festival in northern Germany I went to, one of which, Judas Priest, I got to see for the second time. So I was very, very excited.
And the song you're going to play for us now is a parody of a Judas Priest song.
It is. There I was at, you know, 11 p.m. watching these guys play, and I thought, man, they're singing about breaking the law, but I get to watch people break the laws all day. All day, Dave. The laws of mathematics are broken in my classroom all day.
Take it away.
Okay.
Professors said it was impossible. They said it can't be done. To divide by zero is ridiculous, son. Why do you look stunned? You can try, but you will fail. The answer's undefined. I'm calling bull on that right now. My students do it all the time. But they are breaking the law, breaking the law. 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 Certain things you can't deny, like 1 + 1 = 2. With fractions when you multiply, well, they must be reduced. These laws are concrete, solid rules that'll live throughout the age. A sine wave's output can't be 2. Please crumple up this page. 'Cause you are breaking the law, breaking the law. 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 The square root of a negative seventh grader, please. The answer is imaginary and not quite as it seems. Kids, listen here, do not despair. I've broken these laws too. With practice and some pulling of hair, you are sure to see the truth. So you aren't. Oh, ran out of breath. Here we go. Breaking the law, breaking the law. 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 Thank you.
Andrew Slagle Middle School math teacher at Dillingham City School District and feature performer at the Coffee House this weekend in Dillingham.
Coffee House, this Saturday. Be there.
And we'll see you there.
Amen.
All right. Thanks, man.
Yeah.
The Coffee House happens Saturday at 7 at the Lutheran Church. That's it for this week's show. Find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at the KDLG website. Send feedback and story ideas to me, Dave, at kdlg.org, or give a call at the station. We do enjoy hearing from you more than just for song requests in our trading post. My thanks to Hannah Colton and Molly Dishner for their reporting, and also to Guns N' Roses for their help with the soundtrack this week, and for reminding us this month that it gets hard to hold a candle, and runners end up walking. Of course, most importantly, nothing lasts forever. Come on, winter. We'll see you next week.